Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hi, I'm Caroline.
And I'm Anna.
And this is Seriously, the pop culture podcast from The New Statesman.
Hiya.
Hello.
Welcome back. Sorry, we were off last week. So if you've been sort of scrolling through your subscribed podcast looking for Seriously, like my mum texts me like, I seem to have unsubscribed. Can you send it to me somehow? And I was like, no, we just weren't there. Caroline hasn't been very well. Poor Caroline.
Yeah, I've had a really nasty stomach bug, which I'm not going to give any more details of because people might be eating while they're listening to this.
But yeah. Send her your get well vibes because you're still a little bit ropey, aren't you?
I am. So I apologise if I sound a bit like I'm at the bottom of a well or sad or something.
We're also going to be off the week after this podcast comes out because, do you know what, guys? We think we're allowed a holiday every now and then.
Yeah, Anna's going on holiday.
I am. I'm going to New York City, also East Hampton and Washington, and potentially Philadelphia. So I would like New York suggestions, American listeners, of stuff that I should be doing. So far, I've booked tickets to the Crucible, and that's it. And I'm staying in Williamsburg/Bushwick/Greenpoint. So suggestions, please. I've had an email from a listener who says that she wanted to quickly write and say how much she adores the podcast. And she's been listening to us for about 8 months now, and it's brightened up her pop culture repertoire. She said she wanted to thank us for introducing Detectorists into her life.
Woo!
She says, having been nursing a broken heart.
Aww.
This is a good sound effect. I've been looking for the perfect show to eat Pringles in my bed and watch, and this is it. Detectorists has just been acquired by Netflix.
Yes, I got an email. Netflix's algorithm knows well what I like. I got an email from it telling me that it's now on UK Netflix. And of course, from my sick bed, I immediately logged on and watched
brilliant.
Several episodes and felt better.
There's no excuse, any listeners who haven't checked that out now. And this listener also has a request of other listeners. I wanted to ask if you have heard of a show I watched a few times and have subsequently forgotten the name of and can't find it anywhere. This happens to me all the time.
All the time.
I hate non-Googleable things.
Yes, you want to Google who was that guy in that thing,
yeah,
but you don't know.
But you don't know what the guy was in what thing. So she says, the premise is a mock documentary with a surreal twist where the host is told every week that he has to do something, i.e. divorce his wife, even though he's happily married. And the show follows this process. I remember finding it simply great, but it is a little hard to explain and nearly impossible to Google. So I just thought I'd throw it out there and ask if anyone else had heard of this. So
I can't say I have, but hopefully listeners are better watched and well-versed in what's going on than I am.
Do you have one of these where you still can't figure out what it was, the thing that you watched? Because I do, and it's been haunting me for like years.
I'm sure I do, but I can't think of what it is right now. What's yours?
Mine is a programme. It was on CBBC or CITV when I was growing up. It was really dark for like a kids' TV programme, and that's why it sticks out in my mind so much. And they were being stalked by someone who was like doing weird shit to their family, including one time they went out to do the shopping, came back, and there was a note on the doorstep saying, I hope you forgot to buy dog food. And they went into their kitchen, and the dog had been murdered.
Ah, that's so horrible.
I know. And then the conclusion of this story was that the oldest daughter had a boyfriend. So they had to relocate to Australia. They were English to like hide from this person. They were in witness protection. It was her boyfriend and she was still sending him postcards. So he knew where they were.
That's horrific.
Or maybe it was her boyfriend's dad. I don't remember. Anyway, I really want to know what that program was. Get on the non-Googleable answers to our
Come
weird
on.
Question.
Come on,
I mean, what's the point of you if not to just answer our weird whims and bizarre questions.
Why else did we start this podcast? It's not to create a human hive mind for our own purposes. So we've also had an email from Indigo, who said, "It's such a pleasure to listen to you chat while I'm on the subway and at work. I'm an acting student in New York, though I'm from New Zealand, and I find it quite refreshing to hear such lovely non-American accents saying such funny and thoughtful things."
Oh, thanks. Your life sounds cool.
You've moved halfway around the world and you live in New York, you're an acting student. Ooh, yeah, you're doing pretty well.
That's a Lena Dunham TV show in the making.
Totally, I would watch that. Flight of the Conchords meets Girls. Indigo also recommends a German film called Look Who's Back, a comedy based on the premise that Hitler has been transported to 2014 Berlin.
Bizarre.
I'm intrigued by this. I'm going to check this out. It reminds me of one of the worst, I think, episodes of Doctor Who since its reboot.
I remember that one.
Which was called Let's Kill Hitler.
Yeah, it's. I guess at some point you have to do the murdering Hitler episode of Doctor Who.
It is the eternal time travel question, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they did do it and it was terrible. While we're going to be off next week, we are also working on an extra special episode for the end of the month because it is the 1 year anniversary of Seriously.
Seriously is a year old. Can you believe it? There will be some people who've been listening from the beginning who are like, I feel so haggard. I feel so tired.
If you are one of those people, we would like to hear from you, by the way. If you've been here since the first episode, let us know.
Hi, yeah, Mum.
God, all the way back to us. Do you remember we read Grey by E.L.
James? I do remember. And we did a One Direction playlist, which was very hashtag on brand.
It was.
And remains so.
So we're working on a special episode to mark our first birthday, and we would like your recommendations for things that you think we should have done in the first year of Seriously, but haven't.
Yeah, what are your standout things that you thought, oh, that's a really Seriously thing that we didn't do? You can check the archive. We don't want loads of suggestions of stuff that we have actually done.
Yeah, so seriouslypod.com if you want to just scroll back through what we've already done, or iTunes or whatever. And yeah, we'd like to hear from you. We'll try and watch as many of them as we can in advance and talk about them on the birthday episode.
And just so you know, the wearing of party hats will be obligatory for all listeners.
We'll be able to tell if you're not wearing a hat.
We'll know.
The first thing we're going to talk about this week is Peaky Blinders, which is a BBC historical crime drama about the exploits of a family-run gang in Birmingham in the early 20th century. The first series began just after the First World War, and we've now followed the fortunes of the Shelby family up to 1924, where the third series begins. It stars Cillian Murphy, Helen McCrory, and Tom Hardy.
Look how far we've come. It's a family united.
The Russians have made contact. They are very dangerous people. So are we.
For them, family is a weakness. For me, it's my strength.
They're being watched.
We can reach anyone, anywhere. We should never have got into this, Tom.
Yeah, so I watched the first episode of the third series, which is currently all on iPlayer. I hadn't seen either of the first two seasons, so I didn't really know what I was getting in for, and my overall thoughts were, wow, this is extremely slick. This is an American TV show on British TV. It seems high budget.
It's Boardwalk Empire or something, isn't it? It's that kind of level of production, which is quite unusual for British television, for something to look that obviously expensive.
Yeah, and to have such a coherent style. I feel like you could watch 5 minutes or 5 seconds even of Peaky Blinders and you'd immediately be like, this is Peaky Blinders. Mm. It's got a really core soundtrack of modern rock music. So the theme is Nick Cave, and there was another Nick Cave song in the episode I was watching, and Arctic Monkeys and Radiohead, that kind of thing. It's got a really clear sound, and there's lots of slow-mo shots, and everyone is dressed amazing.
It's quite dark, and
the visually
shots are generally quite gloomy almost. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I loved that about it, because it was just immediately, both visually and sonically, you were like, I know what this is. And I enjoyed that, because it sort of really pulls you along with a programme when you can invest in that, I think. Have you watched previous seasons?
I have, yeah. So I didn't actually become aware of it until the Christmas after the first series was on, when my dad bought the DVD of the whole first series, and we marathoned it in one whole day, I think, over the Christmas period.
I bet a lot of dads
period.
Like this.
Yeah, my dad really likes it.
Yeah.
The first series is set in 1919. The Shelby boys, of which there are three main characters, one of them played by Cillian Murphy, Thomas, he's the kind of main guy. They've all just come back from the First World War, and they've all had variously horrible experiences, as have all of their friends and everyone who they know in and around Birmingham. And at that point, they're a pretty small-time gang. They live in a terraced house on a really grimy street by I think it's an arms factory in Birmingham. They run a couple of pubs in the local area, and they have a few low-key contacts in the police. Oh, and they're illegal bookmakers out the back of their own house, but that's it.
Mm-hmm.
But Thomas Shelby's come back from the war going, I'm not fucking around anymore. I'm going growing bigger, I'm going home. He was a tunneler, like in Birdsong, and nearly died under the mud of France for no apparent reason. Because this is his thing. He wins a medal while he's in France. You know, he's a very good soldier. But he comes back completely divorced of any patriotism or any sense of loyalty to his country.
Well, that why was quite a common reaction, wasn't it, to the First World War? Just people still having no clue why it happened or what the point of it was.
So he comes back going, I just don't care anymore. I don't even care if I die. I'm just going to go for it. And so he embarks on this rapid expansion plan that sees them take over other people's businesses and basically grow their empire all the way through the second series up until the point at the beginning of the third series where you watch where he now owns this big house and he's a legitimate bookmaker as well as an illegal one. He's got all these shady international deals going on. He's become really big time.
Yeah, and there's a thread in this that like Churchill wants him to do something.
Yeah, so the secondary storyline throughout the whole thing has been that Birmingham has what they call in the first series a Fenian problem, in the sense that the struggle for independence in Ireland is being partly played out in England with people who are refugees from the political struggle have come to England and so on. And this Northern Irish policeman played by Sam Neill gets sent by Churchill to Birmingham to sort out the Fenian problem. And he very quickly realises that actually his biggest problem is Thomas Shelby. It's not the Fenians, because he's quickly getting so much influence in the police and stuff that actually it's really Shelby who's running the town. So they have this long-running battle. And I don't think it's too much of a spoiler to say that ultimately Shelby comes out on top. And Churchill gets this grudging respect from him almost. At this point, Churchill is Home Secretary, he's not Prime Minister. That Shelby is a useful evil.
Yeah.
That he's that eternal figure, the kind of noble gangster, in the sense that there are some things he won't do. And therefore, he can mostly be trusted to at least act consistently in his own interests, if nothing else. So that's why Churchill occasionally calls upon him to act as an intermediary for international arms deals and various other stuff. He's got this reluctant establishment link, even if he hates the establishment and everything it stands for. And so at the beginning of the episode you watch, we saw Thomas Shelby's wedding.
Yeah, so he gets married. I've also seen the second episode via Gogglebox. It's his wedding day, but as you might expect from this gangster, it's quickly becoming overshadowed by, quote, business, quote. I actually found the minutiae of this quite difficult to follow with Russians and
It's always like that. I generally find with it that you don't really understand what's going on until the final scene of the final episode.
I mean, even then I was a bit like, okay, well, I'll just go along with this then. But I do think the relationships between the characters was well done and interesting, regardless of sort of what else was going on. The, like, best man loyalty was good, and then, like, Shelby being convinced his best man was going to fuck everything up
for him. So that's his brother, Arthur, who has had all kinds of problems with addiction and rage and things in the past. And as a result, I think Thomas is really worried that he's going to have
drunk
too much whiskey and ruin his wedding. And he's particularly stressed because his new in-laws are all, like, posh English cavalry officers. And there's obviously this kind of low-level tension that... Because the Shelbys are also... They have gypsy heritage as well. So a lot of their relations are definitely not people that the army officers want to hang out with.
Yeah, so it all comes to a head, basically, in the final scenes of this episode. And it does a thing that is one of my pet hates in TV and movies. So this was my downside of Peaky Blinders, where they had, like, two people fucking and two people having a massive fist fight and two people wrestling over, like, a gun and then some sort of more abstract scheming, quote marks, or, like, cutting between shots with some, like, heavy music. I always really hate that. I just find it such a cliche when you're like, ooh, two people are having sex, but two people are going to kill each other, and like, oh, I just, it makes hairs on the back of my neck go a bit like, oh, this is lame, I don't like it. So that was my downside. But then by the end it'd come right back up to that really stylish sort of slow-mo walking, big music, like, enjoyed. So a mixed bag. But I think the premise as well is just, I know I'm 3 years too late on this, but such a great premise. Love the idea of finding this Birmingham gang and being like, we're going to do a TV show about this, and we're going to do it in the big American glossy style, and we're going to do it on the BBC and make it like a regional British thing as well.
Yeah,
really
and,
cool.
And it's been really cool, actually. I've seen a little bit of how the response has been, not in London, like they do the premiere of it in Birmingham and stuff like that.
It's really cool.
It's really cool.
It's quite BBC to do that.
Yeah,
isn't it?
And you get more of this, I think, in the first series more than anything, but it's very grounded in its place in the first series. So there's lots of like like canal stuff and going out to see their gypsy relatives just outside Birmingham and stuff.
And the accents and everything. Mm. It's nice to see like Tom Hardy coming into a production like this and like doing, you know.
He's introduced in the second series when they expand to London.
Yeah.
Because he plays a Jewish gangster, so they expand into North London and he meets them then. What did you think of Aunt Poll, Helen McCrory's character?
Yeah, she's a great actress, isn't she? I couldn't quite pin her down. It seems like so her loyalty is to Shelby above everyone, and she's just doing everything based on what's best for him.
So they're kind of the senior partners in the firm, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
Aunt Poll and Thomas are, well, they're the smartest, and they have this kind of intellectual partnership, whereas everyone else is kind of just there when they need the muscle, almost. But they are the ones setting the strategy. She's always been, even back when they were just bookmakers, she looked after the money, so she was the kind of bookkeeper, and so as a result she's always known exactly what's going on, and she has this very firm line. It's like, I don't really care what you do as long as I'm not surprised by it. You always have to tell me what you're going to do.
Yeah, no, I like her a lot, and it's nice to see a slightly older woman at the head of a crime syndicate like that. That's pretty cool.
And there was a really good storyline in the first series. This is one of my favorite bits of the whole thing. So Grace, who is Thomas's now wife, they first met because she was a police informant for the policeman that Churchill sent to Birmingham, Sam Neill. She's Irish, and just she got work as a barmaid in one of Shelby's pubs and stuff, and they kind of got on and started courting and all the rest of it. And all the time she was like telling his enemy what he was up to. Aunt Poll worked this out much sooner than Thomas did. And so they had this kind of low-level enmity where Aunt Poll was basically waiting for the opportune moment to expose her. Mm. She was waiting for the moment of greatest advantage. And they had this fantastic standoff in one of the pubs where Aunt Poll just walks in and pulls the hat pin out of her hat hair arrangement. And it's like, I know what you are. I know what you're doing. And Grace just pulls a gun out of her hat and is like, oh, really? It's fantastic.
That's really funny. I liked her a lot, and she obviously still doesn't quite trust Grace.
Oh, not
and they
at all.
Have a great scene where that really comes through. So yeah, a great show all in all, and one that I think I'm going to like binge on iPlayer. But I feel sad that I didn't get into it at the beginning, because it's really cool.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Take a little walk to the edge of town and go across the track where the viaduct looms like a bird of doom as it ships and cracks, where secrets lie in the border fires and the humming wires. Yeah, man, you know you're never coming back. Across the square, across the bridge, past the mills, past the stacks. On a gathering storm comes a tall, handsome man in a dusty black coat with a red right hand.
The next thing we're going to talk about is Mustang. Mustang is the debut feature film from Turkish-French film director Deniz Gamze Ergüven. Set in a remote Turkish village, it follows five orphan sisters, Lale, Nur, Ece, Selma and Sone, who live under strict rule while members of their family prepare their arranged marriages. I feel like describing the plot of this film isn't necessarily a good summation of what the film is like to watch. I don't know if you agree.
I do agree, actually, because it's very much an atmosphere and a sort of mood, mm-hmm. more than almost a story. I mean, it is a story in the sense that there's a kind of inciting incident at the beginning and then mm-hmm. a resolution of a kind at the end. But a lot of the things that happen, like I'm thinking particularly of the bit where they go to the football match,
mm-hmm.
it's more about a release of emotion and a sense of temporary freedom than it is because it's really important to the story that they watch football. You know?
Yeah, exactly. So it's a really good film that gets in the mind of what it's like to be a woman at that age. So Lale is the protagonist of the five sisters.
Yeah, you sort of see it through her eyes, don't you?
Yeah, and she's the youngest. And so what do we think she is when the film starts? Maybe 11, 12?
Yeah.
And she is watching her older sisters grow up and, you know, experiencing things, some things for the first time. It begins with that real sense of injustice, really. So the film opens with Lale's teacher leaving at the end of the school year and she's moving to Istanbul and Lale's not going to see her again. She's really sad. Her and all her sisters and some boys go and play on the beach. They're playing that game where you're like on each other's shoulders and trying to push the other one into the sea. And then when they get home, they are like absolutely screamed at and beaten by their grandmother, who's basically like their primary caregiver because their parents aren't around, and for like rubbing their private parts on a boy's neck.
Yeah,
and it's seen as this very sexual act that they were doing.
Yeah.
From the beginning, you get this real sense of like the injustice. And Lale goes outside and she starts breaking a chair to pieces. And her grandmother's like, what are you doing? And she's like, this dirty chair touched our bum holes. It's a disgrace. She's full of this injustice. So you really move through all these different emotions. But basically in this very rural village, as soon as that incident happens, it's like a catalyst for them getting increasingly less freedom. There are literal bars that go up outside their house and they're not allowed to go out anymore. And they're not allowed to go back to school when school starts again. And they're basically from that point trained to become wives and they're taught how to cook and stuff like that. But I thought it was really interesting because this film's, for like good reasons, I think, getting loads of comparisons to The Virgin Suicides.
Yes.
Because they are very similar in terms of plot, although culturally very different. And I think this is a much better film than The Virgin Suicides, even though I love The Virgin Suicides.
The thing that really stands out about this film is that it's all from a female perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas The Virgin Suicides,
it's a little bit more the boys looking in. Yeah.
Whereas this is all from Lale's point of view.
And there are some real concrete like issues at the heart of this film, for want of a better phrase. This is about specific restrictions of freedoms and specific feelings that all teenagers go through. And The Virgin Suicides is a little bit more vague in that sense. And it's just like that sort of dreamlike atmosphere rather than those actual specific emotions and incidents. I thought it was interesting that the director said that she was surprised by those comparisons because she thought she'd made like an escape prison movie. And that was what she was thinking about when she made it. And as the film goes on, it does increasingly become that. And it is very plot driven. And there are lots of little sort of Chekhov's guns in there. Like, so when you see a supermarket delivery guy at the beginning, slowly this relationship between Lale and this basically truck driver builds up throughout the film. You know that he's going to be key when it gets to the end in helping them escape and stuff like that. So you get this real sense of that style of movie when you're watching it as well. So it's a really weird blend of stuff. It's a weird mix of stuff.
It is. And there's also the really dark element of their uncle, who has been abusing more than one of
the
sisters.
Yeah, sort of a slow... the uncle, certainly at the beginning, we see him like physically abusing the girls and hitting them and stuff. And it gets darker and darker as it goes on what his relationship to them might be. But it never feels overly heavy-handed, this film. And I also think it's really interesting for its portrayal of the older women. There's some really lovely moments in this film. So, for example, this football match incident. The girls really want to go, Lale especially loves football, really wants to go to a football match. Her uncle is like, have you seen what the men there are like? Absolutely no way. There's no way I would take young women to that game. Then there's a riot at a football match. And as a result, the local authorities or whatever ban men from attending the next football match. So it's going to be a women-only event. The girls are absolutely so excited, but they know they won't be allowed to go. So they like sneak out and go on the school bus that's driving everyone there. They get seen on the TV by one of their aunties.
I love that bit.
It's so amazing. And then there's a sort of voiceover that comes in and out of this film, but it's very unintrusive. It's a bit like in Juno, where you almost forget that there's a voiceover in it when you get to the end. So the auntie sees them on TV and like unplugs the TV from the ceiling and pretends that it's broken. And then when they go next door to try and watch it, she runs out into the street and starts throwing rocks at like the satellite dish or whatever in the local area, and like destroys the power for the entire village so that no one sees that they're there. You get lots of these moments where you really feel that the older women are looking out for them, but you also get these horrible moments of internalized misogyny where, for example, they'll marry off young girls that they think might have had like a sexual experience of any kind, even if it's a traumatic one. Immediately it's like, they're spoiled. I've got to make sure that they get married off, even if it is to someone horrible, no matter what the circumstances.
It's better to be married to someone horrible than not to be married.
Yeah, exactly. And they create problems as much as they try and solve them, but you get a sense that they're not morally good or bad. It's just a really complicated situation. So I thought that was really, really well done. And it's the same with the older sisters. Like, sometimes they make weird decisions, but you're always so firmly on their side. So it's quite nuanced in that sense.
It's interesting what you say about the Prison Break movie, because actually, when watching it, I did have a moment where I thought it's a little bit like Orange is the New Black.
There is something of that about it.
In the way that you would assume with Orange is the New Black that all of the prisoners would be on the same side against the guards, and it's, you know, a kind of us versus them situation, which it's not at all, I suppose, in the loose as possible sense. But everyone's got their own agenda, everyone's got their own priorities, there are different little cliques and partnerships forming and reforming and moving all the time, and that's a little bit what I feel Mustang is like. That it's not as simple as to say, like, the people keeping them in the house are bad and the people being kept in the house are good.
Yeah, we obviously have a villain in the uncle, but that's as far as it really goes. I thought the performances in this were absolutely incredible. These five girls apparently haven't done much acting before, and they were just so brilliant. Lale especially, you know, when you don't even think about the acting because it's so good. It wasn't until afterwards I was like, wow, that performance was amazing, because I was so invested and I was so believing. I never once stopped to think, how is this girl doing this performance?
It reminded me of Jacob Tremblay in Room. Actually, the way I stopped, because you know when you're watching a younger or a child actor, and the whole time you're thinking, wow, this child is really good at acting, rather than thinking, wow, this child I'm so interested in, you know, you just lose that sense of the intermediary because the performance is so good. That's what this felt like.
Yeah, absolutely. So I was talking to a friend about this film, and she said that there's been a bit of controversy in Turkey because people have felt that it's not a very Turkish movie and it's being portrayed as one. Apparently, for example, the accents are regionally like miles off what they should be. And also there's an idea that, so the director is a Turkish-French director, and you could read this film as fairly condemning of Islam, because the family are very religious, and these are Islamic communities, right? Muslim communities. And there was some question of whether that's partially to do with, like, a French culture of increased Islamophobia, whether that comes into play in this film at all. To be honest, these are questions that are so over my understanding, so past my understanding. I don't know anything about Turkey, and I don't really know anything about French Islamophobia either, so I wouldn't give my opinion on it either way, but I just thought it was an interesting extra dynamic to the film that I haven't seen talked about that much.
Yeah, and I suppose it prompts the question that, would a wholly Turkish director working in Turkey make a film like this?
I don't know. And I think as well, it's specific to this director's experience because she is drawing stuff on her own life. And she was born in Turkey, but grew up mostly in France, then went back to Turkey for a few years, and then went back to France again. So those few years were between like 12 and 15 or something. You can understand why that sense of feeling so trapped might have come through in her own particular experience as well. But I do think one of the things that's so great about this film is that it transcends specificity, and it just becomes this, you know, you can relate to it so easily, even though it's miles away from any experience that I would ever have had. And I think that's just like what makes an amazing film, right? That ability for all people to watch it and just be like, wow, this is so, I don't even know what the word is, but it just, I can feel the feelings that are going on in this film, even though it's so outside of my own understanding.
I think it's still on in cinemas, so if you can catch it, definitely do.
I think this is one of the best films I've seen all year, certainly. Loved it. Mustang Sally, guess you better slow that Mustang down. Mustang Sally, my baby, guess you better slow that Mustang.
So, last episode, I recommended that Anna watch 30 Rock, which is, or rather, which was, an NBC sitcom that starred Tina Fey and Alec Baldwin, which ran for 7 series from 2006 to 2013. It was Tina Fey's first major writing and acting project after leaving Saturday Night Live, and it's heavily based on her experiences there. Her character, Liz Lemon, is the head writer at a live topical sketch show based in 30 Rockefeller Plaza. So, Anna, what did you make of it?
Yeah, I thought it was really funny. It's a weird little show, isn't it?
So weird.
Very weird little show. I wonder how many episodes of this show do you think someone needs to watch before they can, like, really appreciate it?
3 or 4?
I watched 2. And I did like it, but I feel like I hadn't got into the rhythm of it. And I think if I had to order like those big American 20-minute sitcom, my order at the moment would be The Office US is my top. I love it. Then Parks and Rec, then 30 Rock. Mm. When we watched Parks and Rec, I liked it a lot more than you did.
Yeah.
And with 30 Rock, I was laughing. I liked Alec Baldwin a lot. I think he was the main source of comedy for me. But there were also moments where I'd be a bit like, yeesh, do we laugh at this? I don't know. I feel uncomfortable. So it was a mixed bag for me. I could already tell that the strength of it, I feel like, is probably going to be in that Liz Lemon, Jack Donaghy relationship. And I also really loved her relationship with her best friend, who's obviously been on the show with her for a long time.
Yes, Jenna.
Yeah, Jenna. I loved that relationship too. I thought that was really funny. So I think those 3 bits for me are probably where the most of the humour comes from.
Yeah, I think that's fair. The other bit that develops and becomes, I think, one of the funniest aspects is the Tracy Jordan character.
So for at the moment, for me, it was so much. And I was like there's a bit where she goes to meet him in a restaurant. She has to put on a nice outfit and stuff. And then she gets there and he's there with like all his black friends. And he's like, I can't eat here. And they go to a fried chicken shop. And I was like, whoa, like.
What really becomes clear, like within the first series, but gets very much developed second to fourth, I'd say, is that Tracy Jordan is a very, very smart self-parodying
character. Well, this is what I thought was maybe coming. And when it didn't come in the first episode, I was like, oh, what is this? I don't get it.
Yeah.
And obviously I just haven't watched enough to get it.
They develop it quite slowly. But, you know, he's constantly like undermining his image as this kind of, oh, I'm just the dumb black guy who does the funny Eddie Murphy star movies, you know. And they do this in all kinds of ways, both in the way that he sort of subverts his own stereotypes, but also just in the vocabulary he uses. Like, one of my favourite lines he ever says is when he's having a bit of a meltdown and he's kind of, I don't know if I should do this or I should do this. And Liz Lemon's trying to be like, okay, Trey, well, let's... And he just goes, it's a quandary! It's a quandary!
It is a quandary. My life's a quandary. Yeah, okay, that's cool. So I should give that the benefit of the doubt and keep going with that plotline.
And he has a kind of interesting relationship with his own background as well. He goes back and sort of revisits at various times. At one point, he writes and stars in a movie about Thomas Jefferson where he plays all of the characters and makes them all black, which I think is probably...
Is this Hamilton?
Yeah, it's like a proto-Hamilton now I think about it.
That's really
Apart from the clips you see of Jefferson, it's terrible. But, you know, his idea is good.
It is. It had legs. Yeah, so do you have like a favourite episode of 30 Rock that you would recommend to listeners?
I have lots of favourite moments. I think probably my favourite whole episode is in the first series and it's called Tracy Does Conan. And it's when...
I know where this is going.
Yeah, so basically Tracy, in order to promote the show, so he's just joined the sketch show as a new cast member. He's a big movie star. He's doing TV for the first time. It's a whole thing. He gets booked on the Conan show in order to promote it. But I can't remember exactly why, but like his prescription for his meds runs out or something, and he starts seeing a small blue Skittle-shaped man everywhere who he thinks is trying to steal his thoughts. And so the episode is very tightly structured, and it's all around Kenneth the Page's quest to get to the pharmacy to get Tracy's prescription so that he can take the meds in time to be on Conan. Because the last time Tracy was on Conan, he lost it and tried to kill Conan. So Conan will not do it unless Tracy is provably sane. So the whole thing is this kind of, almost like a kind of Prison Break style thing in order to just get these meds and get...
That's really funny.
Which I really like.
Okay, cool. Well, I'll give that one a whirl and see how my relationship with 30 Rock develops. Because at the moment, I think my relationship to these programs is like directly corresponds to how many episodes of them I've watched.
Yeah, it's true, isn't it?
Yeah.
This is one of the things about the podcast is we do often have to not watch as much of something as we would necessarily like.
Yeah, exactly. So next time, Caroline, I would like you to watch the recent Louis Theroux BBC Two specials that have been on. I'm sure you've seen Louis Theroux BBC Two specials in the past.
I have, yes.
I mean, you're British, pretty much compulsory, right?
It's true.
So there have been two more on recently. One was called Drinking to Oblivion, and it was about alcoholism. Quite bleak, as you can imagine. And the second is about people who've experienced a sort of traumatic head injury and have, as a result, have, you know, neurological problems. So they're both quite different, but very, very interesting. And it'll give us an excuse to talk about Louis Theroux, which will be fun.
Yeah, love Louis Theroux.
Thanks for listening to Seriously, the pop culture podcast from The New Statesman. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to Seriously. All you have to do is search SRSLY in iTunes or any other podcasting app you use. While you're there, it would be really great if you could leave us an iTunes review, as it helps other people find the show.
We also rely on you listeners for your recommendations, so if you want to tell us what you thought about something, or if you've got something we should watch, you can contact us on Twitter, Facebook, via email. All the details are on seriouslypodcast.com. If you like, you can also recommend us to your friends, family, neighbours, strangers. Let them know that you like the podcast and they should be listening to it too.
It's time for another season of The Palmetto Porch, an original podcast from Discover South Carolina. I'm Devin Whitmire. Join me as I get to the heart of what makes South Carolina such a great place to visit by speaking to the locals who make it so special. Premiering December 5th, find The Palmetto Porch wherever you get your podcasts. And for more information about our show, visit scpalmettoporch.com.